Hi, this is Susie Larson, and thank you so much for listening to Live the Promise today. Our website is filled with even more powerful and encouraging interviews. Learn more by logging on to myfaithradio.com. Afternoon. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'm Susie Larson, and this is Live the Promise. And we are here to help you engage in a strong and active walk of faith. Really glad you're listening today. Well, we're talking today about building strong relationships, and I'm excited for you to be listening. Dr. Gary Chapman joins me this hour, and for the first half hour, we'll be talking about the languages of apology. Just as there are love languages, there are all different ways that we can communicate to say I'm sorry to someone in our life. It's really an art. We're going to talk about that in each language today and how we can learn to speak to someone in their language of apology. Very practical takeaways. Then in the second half hour, Dr. Chapman and I will look at the current trend of gray divorce. More and more couples today are choosing divorce after being married 20, 30, and even 40 years. We're going to talk about how to build a marriage that will last a lifetime. Just a quick announcement first. We got a huge response from my interview with John Eldridge on the power of prayer and moving mountains. You can find that whole podcast up on our website at myfaithradio.com. That's myfaithradio.com. So let me not waste another moment and tell you about this guest today. Dr. Gary Chapman is an author and speaker with over 30 years of counseling experience. He's best known for the number one New York Times bestselling book, The Five Love Languages. You can find his work and his resources on his author page at our website, myfaithradio.com. Dr. Chapman, welcome back to the program.
Well, thank you, Susie. It's good to be with you.
Always good to be with you as well. Wondering if you have a verse that you've been sort of tossing around, pondering these days, or even a life verse you can share with us.
Fear thou not, for I am with thee. Be not dismayed, I am thy God. I will strengthen thee. Yea, I will help thee. Yea, I will uphold thee with the right hand of my righteousness. Isaiah 41:10.
Powerful. Talk about how that's been impacting you these days.
You know, so many times throughout my life when I would be dealing with whatever issues were coming along, that verse has been brought to my mind by God and has just ministered to me. Because, you know, Susie, when everything else is said and done, it's the presence of God with you in your situation that gives you what you need to take the next step and keep walking.
So
I have just found that verse to be a great, great encouragement in my life, both in the times that things are going, you know, easy and well, but in the times when things are a little rocky and hard, the presence of God makes all the difference.
Boy, does it ever. Presence of God makes all the difference. Well, you open your great book, When Sorry Isn't Enough, by describing this innate cry for reconciliation that exists in every human heart. I want you to unpack that for a minute. How does this cry connect to forgiveness in our relationships?
Well, I think, Susie, all of us have the desire to have loving, supportive, caring relationships. If you're married, you want that in your marriage. If you're a parent, you want to have that kind of relationship with your child. And really, just in friendships, we need that. We want that. We were not designed to live alone in isolation. I mean, even God said it's not good for man to be alone, cut off, isolated. And in those relationships, we really want them to be positive. We want them to be helpful. And the big problem, of course, is that all of us are human. And as humans, we don't always do the right thing. We don't always say the right thing. We sometimes say things that hurt and cut the other person and do things that let them down, as it were. And that's why apology and forgiveness is so important, is that it helps us get over the hurdle of our failures. You know, when we fail each other, it's like putting a block, an emotional block, in a wall between the two of us. And if you don't deal with it, it just sits there. And then you have another failure and another block and another, and eventually you have a long wall between the two of you, and the relationship is cold and or hostile. So if you want to keep the relationship positive, we have to deal with our failures. I like to say, Susie, we don't have to be perfect to have good relationships, but we do have to deal with our failures, and that involves apology and forgiveness.
And what I think is so amazing is how you've identified that we all, just like the five love languages, need to receive an apology in a certain way. I mean, we take Kev and I, for example. We just celebrated our 30th anniversary. He's a gentle giant of a man, steady Eddie kind of guy, doesn't ever yell. He's just a wonderful, kind guy, and he would say himself his bend at times is towards workaholism. He's come a long way with that. But when we would have conflict, neither of us are yellers. I might escalate a little, but neither of us are yellers. But the hard thing would be when he would do something wrong and I would tell him, his response always was why he did that thing or how to fix that thing. And I never felt satisfied in conflict until I read this in your book, that what I needed was for him to identify what he'd done. Otherwise, I didn't feel satisfied or even safe in the resolution. I walked away with this kind of gnawing thing in my gut going, that is still a loose end for me. So why is it and how is it that we're so different as far as what we need in that process?
I think what happens is that as we grow up, our parents teach us how to apologize. Or sometimes they teach us not to apologize. You know, there are fathers who say to their sons, real men don't apologize. Now, that's a handicap for a young man if he hears that message from his father, because the reality is real men must apologize. It's a sign of strength to apologize. But typically, our parents will teach us how to apologize. Little Johnny pushes his sister down the stairs, and his mother says, Johnny, you don't do that to sister. Go tell her you're sorry. So little Johnny says, I'm sorry. Even if he's not. I'm sorry, okay? He's 25. He's married. He offends his wife. What's he going to say? I'm sorry. That's what his mother taught him. But the problem is we have different mothers and different fathers, and we didn't all learn the same idea of what an apology is. And we tend to judge a person's apology based on what we consider to be a sincere apology. As you said, very similar to the love languages. We assume that what we want to hear for an apology is the same thing they want to hear, and that's a wrong assumption. So what we're saying in this book, When Sorry Isn't Enough, is that we have to learn how to apologize in a language or in a manner that the other person considers to be a sincere apology. If we are sincere, let us try to communicate it in a way that will convey our sincerity to them.
And this is so practical. I absolutely love this book. So let's walk through these. Since we only have you for the first half hour, I want to make sure we cover them. So the first one is expressing regret. And you suggest that we ask the question, how often do I correct problems without assuming responsibility or expressing regret? And maybe that's what I was feeling. I wanted to hear him say, this is what I did, and I can see that it hurt you, and I wish I wouldn't have done that. You know, just something like that. So talk about that, what that looks like.
Yeah. Expressing regret is probably the most common of these languages, and it is often expressed with the words, I'm sorry. But I like to say, please don't say those two words alone. Tell them what you're sorry for, not just I'm sorry, but I'm sorry that I lost my temper and yelled at you. I'm sorry that I came home an hour and a half late and we have now missed the program. I know you wanted to go, and I really feel badly about that. What you're trying to do in this language of apology is to communicate to them that you are feeling badly about what you've done. You realize that what you have done or sometimes failed to do has hurt them deeply and consequently hurt your relationship. So you're trying to communicate that, you know, to the other person that you feel sorry. It's like the prodigal son who said to his father, I'm not worthy to be called your son. Could you just give me a job, Dad? You feel the pain in his heart. I mean, you sense that he regrets what he's done. And that's what this language is trying to communicate. And there are people, if you don't communicate this sense that you feel badly about what happened, you regret what you've done, they don't see it as a sincere apology. And as you said earlier, you just kind of it's left dangling emotionally.
Yeah.
And it's more difficult to really genuinely forgive them and get it behind you.
Because the why, even though that's important, to me that's secondary as to the what. Because it's like, I just need to know that we're on the same page and you know what exactly hurt me. Because you don't feel safe otherwise that's not going to happen again. So part, right. I love what you said about putting words with sorry, because then it's like I'm understanding what I did to hurt you. I see it, and I for that, I'm sorry. Not, I'm sorry we're having this fight. I'm sorry your face is contorting that way. I'm sorry for what I did. Okay. Accepting responsibility. You say that often. Our reluctance to admit that we were wrong is tied to our self-worth. Say more there.
Yeah, I think this, again, is one of the fundamental languages of apology, is to say to the other person, I realize that what I did was wrong. Mm. You may be honestly say, you know, I didn't intend to do it. I wasn't thinking about it. But now that I look at it, I realize it was wrong. I should not have done that. I take full responsibility for that. And again, there are people for whom this is what a sincere apology is. It's expressing the fact that you were wrong. Now, sometimes I have particularly guys who say to me, well, Dr. Chapman, what if you don't think you're wrong? You know, I mean, she thinks you're wrong, but you don't really think you did anything wrong. And I say, I'm not talking necessarily about morally wrong. I'm talking about something you did or failed to do or said or didn't say that has hurt the relationship. For example, my wife had one of our chairs reupholstered, okay? It happened to be a chair that I use on a regular basis. Well, I came home one day, and there was this chair with a new, you know, covering on it.
Surprise!
And she said to me, honey, how do you like it? And I said, well, honey, I like it. I said, but, you know, really, I like the old one better. And she just broke into tears. And she said, I can't believe you said that. It took me 2 months going all over town to find the right material, and then you don't like it?
Mm-hmm.
Now, Susie, what I said was not morally wrong, okay? But it was wrong. It hurt our relationship. Mm. It hurt her. And I wasn't being very thoughtful about it. So that's what I'm talking about. You know, I needed to say to her, honey, I'm sorry. Not only I'm sorry, but I was wrong. I should not have shared that. I should have not have said that to you. So let's get over the hurdle of, you know, well, it's not morally wrong, so I don't need to say I'm wrong. If you hurt the other person, your behavior, then you need to admit that you did it and it's wrong. So and the reason I tie that in with self-esteem, the people that have the most difficult time saying I was wrong are children who grew up in homes where their parents seldom ever told them what they did right, but
wow.
Every day they told them what they did wrong. And something inside that child growing up said, if I ever get to be an adult, I'll never be wrong again. And so they have a hard time saying I am wrong. I should not have done that, because it communicates to them that they're a bad person. And they have to get over that hang-up, you know, from the past, to recognize that all of us do wrong from time to time. And to admit that what you did is wrong doesn't mean that you are a bad person any more than anybody else is a bad person. We're all sinners, you know. But it means that we have to acknowledge that in this case, what I did was wrong, and I'm willing to admit that. And for some people, this is what they're waiting to hear, is for you to admit that what you did was wrong.
And that's what brings safety back into the relationship. So good. I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise. We're talking with one of my favorite guests, Dr. Gary Chapman. Just as there are 5 love languages, there are also 5 ways we can apologize to someone. We've talked about expressing regret, accepting responsibility. Well, when we come back, we'll talk about the 3rd kind of apology, making restitution. More with Dr. Chapman when we return. Great song, and it kind of gets you going, doesn't it? I'm Susie Larson. This is Live the Promise, talking to Dr. Gary Chapman today about the art of apology. Oh, my goodness. It's not even a very thick book, but it is so practical, and I think it could save lots of relationships. So we are talking about just these different languages and ways that we each need to receive an apology to feel like it's satisfying and reconciling. Otherwise, we feel missed. And so we talked about expressing regret. We talked about accepting responsibility. And so some really receive an apology when the other offers to make restitution. And you say restitution often extends beyond expressing love through speaking one of the five love languages of love. So talk about the person who needs restitution made.
Essentially here, we're trying to communicate to the other person that we would like to make this up to them. How can I make this up? I know I've hurt you. I know it was wrong. But what can I do that might make it easier for you to forgive me? It's offering to make restitution. And some people have never thought of this. I mean, they just think if I say I'm sorry, then that's enough. But really, it's not enough. There are some people, if you don't offer to make restitution, then in their mind, you haven't really apologized. And they may even say that. Well, I'm sorry is not an apology. If you really were sincere, you'd offer to make it right. So I think this is a key apology language, and many people have never even thought about it. But I'm telling you, for many people, this is what they consider to be an apology.
So how does a person identify what they need? Do you ask them, what do you need, especially if they haven't read this book? I think it would be light bulb if they would read it. But let's say they haven't. What does a spouse ask another spouse to find out? What do you need when we are in conflict to feel resolved after conflict?
I think one thing would be to say, you know, honey, when I have hurt you, just help me here. When I hurt you, either by something I say or do or fail to do or say, and I'm trying to apologize, what would you most like to hear me say? What communicates to you my sincerity? Because I want to learn how to apologize. Yeah, just asking that question, and very likely they will give you an answer.
Yeah, they're thinking about it.
it'll fall in one of these five categories. That one of these will be the predominant idea they have of what it means to apologize sincerely.
So interesting. Kathy's calling in from Jamestown. Kathy, welcome. You're on the air.
Thank you so much. I love you both so much. This is just amazing. Mm. One of the things that strike me is that I think oftentimes when there's a conflict, that the feeling that comes across is to my husband, I have failed.
Right.
Or I'm a failure.
Mm-hmm.
And that's horrible. So then, of course, he closes down, and then it's just so negative. And I thought, no, you haven't failed. It's just that we haven't been able to hear each other or resolve things. The other quick thing that comes to my mind is when there's a hurt is, have you heard how that affects me? Or tell me what you've heard so that I can sense that he really hears me. Because that's
excellent.
Frustrating.
What do you say, Dr. Chapman? Yeah. That's great,
no,
Kathy.
I think Kathy's exactly right. You know, it's asking the other question. It's trying to determine how they perceive what you have done or how they perceive what you've said. You know, if you make an effort at an apology and it sounds like they're not accepting it or they're questioning your apology, you know, to say to them, well, what do you hear me saying? You know, I think I'm trying to apologize, but what do you hear me saying? And they say, well, I think if you really were trying to apologize, you would offer to make it right, for example. And you can say, now tell me what you mean by that, and let them explain it so that you're getting the idea that this is what they consider to be an apology.
Mm.
And the fact is that when you apologize in a manner that's meaningful to them, you're touching their heart, and they're far more likely to be able to forgive you and let it go and move on down the road.
Yeah, and you sure can see where identity and security, all those things factor in, because I love even just for you, your comment about the chair, your favorite chair. Your ultimate goal was to have oneness as a team again versus right and wrong. And you think in Scripture says love keeps no account. If it's all about keeping count, who's more wrong, who's more right, you won't have a bridge to build. But if you remember, you're in this together and you're building things up together. We only have a couple more minutes and I want to make sure we get these. And this one I thought was so interesting, genuinely repenting. What people who've been hurt want to know is, do you intend to change or will this happen again next week? They want to hear about your intention to change. Talk about that language of genuinely repenting.
But if you don't express the desire to change your behavior, then some people will feel that you're not sincere in your apology. What you're saying here is, you know, the word repentance means to turn around. What you're really saying is, I don't like this about me. I don't like what I did. I know I did it last week. I don't want to keep doing this. Can we talk? Can you help me? can we find a plan so I won't do this again? You see, you're not just saying you're sorry. You're actually really sincerely trying to change that behavior. You're asking them to help you come up with a plan where you won't do that again. Mm. And typically, if this is their language, I can tell you, they will help you come up with a plan. I remember the wife who said to me, she said, you know, Dr. Chapman, when my husband got angry one time, he picked up our baby and started shaking our baby. And she said, I just grabbed the baby and said, don't do that to our baby. And said, I ran to the bedroom and I was just bawling. And she said, eventually he knocked on the door and asked me if he could come in. And he came in and he said, honey, I can't believe I did that. You know I love our baby. I can't believe I did that. I don't ever want to do that again. Can you help me? Can we get a plan so I won't do that again? She said, Dr. Chapman, I saw his sincerity, and I was willing to forgive him, and we came up with a simple plan that if he ever felt he was about to lose it with one of our children, he would simply say to me, honey, I'm getting hot. I've got to take a walk. And I knew what that meant, and he could take a walk. And she said, that was 8 years ago. It's never happened again.
Wow.
She said, he's taken a lot of walks, but he's never shaken our baby again.
Yeah, that is amazing. What a good story. Wow. Well, the fifth one is requesting forgiveness. And I want you to talk about why this request is so important to some and why making the request for the other can be so difficult.
Yeah. Well, you know, I must be honest with you. This is one that really didn't resonate much with me. I always thought, you know, if you're apologizing in any way, don't they know you want to be forgiven? Mm. Why do you have to say, will you please forgive me? Well, because for some people, this is what it means to apologize, is you request forgiveness of them. And however you word it, you know, I hope you can find it in your heart to forgive me. I really hope you will forgive me because I value our relationship. And so will you forgive me? And for some people, that's what they're waiting for. And if you don't ask forgiveness, in their mind, whatever else you've said, you're not quite through. I mean, they're waiting to hear you say, will you forgive me? Because that acknowledges that if they don't forgive you, the barrier's going to sit there. And you're reaching out and asking for mercy instead of justice. Hmm. And now they have a choice to forgive you or not to forgive you. But for most people, if this is what they consider to be a sincere apology, they're going to forgive you, and that's going to make it easier for them to do it.
That makes a lot of sense. I mean, trying to put myself in that person's position, if it feels like the other person's more about explaining again their actions, and that next step would be, I want to rebuild this bridge again. I guess I can see where that would maybe be important for some who really need that. You know, I'm thinking about, and Scripture talks about, don't make light of the Lord's discipline and don't lose heart when he rebukes you. He disciplines those he loves. It's really a great, I think, parallel for us in marriage, not to make light when we have hardships, but don't fall apart in a heap, like Kathy was saying, when we have hardships, that truly this is conflict is going to happen, but that it can really be a potential and a catalyst to even a deeper relationship, can it?
I think on the other side of a failure and apology and forgiveness, there is a deeper intimacy.
Yeah.
Because the couple have walked through pain together, and they've been empathetic with each other, and they've been willing to forgive, and they feel even closer together. So, you know, I just think that apologizing and forgiving is an absolute necessity to long-term healthy relationships.
Such good conversation. Well, when we return, you'll hear my conversation with Dr. Gary Chapman about a trend that we're seeing today, and it's called graying divorce, people getting divorced after many years together. He's got a brand new book. It's titled Married and Still Loving It, The Joys and Challenges of the Second Half. More with Dr. Chapman when we return. I can say everybody made me lift my eyes up. Every burden only made me stronger. Every sorrow only made your joy go deeper and deeper, deeper and deeper. That is Meredith Andrews' brand new song. And I just got to tell you, she and I will be doing a conference together in St. Cloud this fall called Thrive. It's going to be fantastic. If you're a woman, I pray that you'll join us. Well, welcome back. I'm Susie Larson. Hey, if you just tuned in, you missed my first half hour conversation with Dr. Chapman about the art of apology. And I got to tell you, that is a re-air because we received so much response from that particular interview. Now we're going to move into a trend. Maybe you're seeing it as well. People are talking about it. It's something called graying divorce. It's when people get divorced after being married 20, 30 in 40 years. Dr. Chapman just released a book to remedy this issue, and the book is titled Married and Still Loving It, The Joys and Challenges of the Second Half. So, Dr. Chapman, I would love to know how you decided this is the next book I have to write. This is the issue I have to address.
You know, I've had this on the back of my mind for a long time. Because I've moved into the second half of marriage some time ago, and I just sensed that there needed to be a book. It hasn't been a book written on this in a long time that of any substance that I've been able to find. And so Harold Myra, who, you know, for 30-plus years was the CEO of Christianity Today magazine, approached Moody Publishers with his interest in this book, and Moody knew my interest. So they put the two of us together, and it was a great project. I really enjoyed working with Harold. He did a lot of the interviewing of couples for this this book, and it's just been a real joy. But it's been there for a long time, just waiting to get out, and I'm really glad we finally got it published.
Congratulations. It was so well done. Very interesting with the stories you share, interviews with Jerry and Diana Jenkins and Ken and Johnny Erickson Tata and John and Cindy Trent. Honest to goodness, great interviews. Just brings it, it keeps it real, you know. I'd love to know, though, Dr. Chapman, what you have learned about gray divorce. What have you seen? What are the stats? What are you seeing out there?
You know, I don't know the stats, and as you well know, the stats are sometimes convoluted. It's hard to get the stats. But all of us know, personally, couples who have divorced in the second half of marriage. Many of them say to themselves, we're going to stay together till the kids get off and go to college. But you know, Susie, when I speak on college campuses, the students who come up to talk to me afterwards, many times, will say to me, you know, Dr. Chapman, my mom and dad divorced after I came to college, and it's just been the hardest thing I've ever dealt with in my whole life. I think parents don't realize that whenever you divorce, it is traumatic for your children because you're the most important people in their lives. And if the two of you can't get it together, they're asking themselves, will I ever be able to have a good marriage? So it's really worth the effort to learn how to have a good marriage in the second half.
So it really is a misnomer, and I've heard people say this, that once the kids get off to college, then we're going to do our own thing, as if they're all set by then. But based on what you're hearing, that is absolutely not accurate. It's as destabilizing then as it is when they're kids.
Yeah, that is absolutely not the case. And keep this in mind. They are alone at the university. You know, when they're younger, at least they're somebody around them. They're with one of the parents, but now they're out there away from both parents, and there's nobody there really with whom they can talk. So, yeah, I'm not encouraging people to get married before they go off to college. I'm just saying, look, let's work at our marriages, and let's not just assume that because we fell out of love or we don't like certain things that we can't have a good marriage, because I believe you can. And I know that one person can't do it alone, but there are a lot of things that one person can do to begin to change the climate in a relationship like that.
Well, you've done a lot of teaching, writing, and talking about some of the factors that, you know, contribute to a successful marriage: communication, mutual respect, making time for each other, healthy approaches to conflict. Would you say that there's a gradual letting go of these things prior to these graying divorces, or is there something even more systemic and, you know, at a deeper level than that?
I think most of the time when people come to divorce, first of all, they've never learned how to speak each other's love language, so they don't feel loved and haven't felt loved for years. They've never learned how to successfully solve their conflicts, and so the conflicts sit unresolved between the two of them. And eventually, they get the feeling, we just married the wrong person. This is just not going to work. And consequently, out of that emptiness, one of them will fall in love with somebody else. Typically, they don't divorce, really, until one of them has some prospect of another relationship.
You know, I've heard this from women who are, you know, approaching their 50s, and they feel like their hubby's maybe settled into a lot of old jokes, that he's getting old, and she still has some semblance of beauty and a sense of youthfulness in her. And she suddenly, you can see it, and I've heard women talk about this, where it's like, I don't want to talk about being old. I've still got some youthfulness left in me. I'm not ready to settle into the senior year, so to speak. And you can start to see maybe the light go out of her eyes because there's suddenly a departure. The kids are gone, and she's not feeling romanced anymore. These are some things that I feel like we need a reset when the kids are gone. We're such creatures of habit. We get into our mode, but there really is a time to maybe redefine what we need, what's helpful, what's not in this time, wouldn't you say?
Well, I think that's exactly right, and that's why we, in the book, we make a lot in one of the chapters about adventure. You know, as long as we're alive, we're on a journey. And couples who have good relationships in the second half put adventure into their relationship, doing things you haven't done for a while. We're all creatures of habit, and we tend to fall into a rut, you know, and do the same things over and over. And this may be as simple as going a different route to the grocery store, okay? Let's just start there. Don't go the same old way. Or going to a restaurant that you haven't gone to in a long time, or maybe ever. We tend to get, again, into a rut. We go to the same three or four restaurants rather than trying something else. Or how about visiting a church that you've never visited before? I'm not talking about moving your membership. I'm just talking about visiting and seeing how someone else worships God. And, you know, maybe take a trip back to your honeymoon destination. Incidentally, Susie, Carolyn and I tried that, and the hotel had been torn down.
Well, it's a different kind of adventure, huh?
Yeah,
we're still standing.
We
the hotel's not
one.
The... Yeah.
Right. Or how about getting on a train and taking a trip anywhere? I mean, how long has it been since you've been on a train, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So what we're saying is you don't have to have a mundane relationship in the second half. You can keep adventure into the marriage. And as Christians, we also have the perspective we're here to serve. So maybe we can do some service together. Maybe we can volunteer to work in a soup kitchen if we've never done that. But do something to serve other people together. Something about serving others together draws the two of you together.
Mm, so good. I know this isn't for everybody, but for us, my dad had died. Our youngest son had moved out within months of each other, and the emptiness and the echo in our home was just palpable. I mean, truly. And there was just a restlessness. At the same time, there were headhunters offering my hubby jobs in a warmer climate. And I'm like, we'll take it. We didn't, because we're called to live here. But, you know, with all of that, the winds of change were blowing. And I know this isn't for everybody, but for us, we moved in closer to work into a Rambler. So instead of having like a two-story, we have a Rambler. So just two floors. We use every inch of space. But the new atmosphere has done absolute wonders. And we established this table in our downstairs family room. It's like a tall table. It's our date table. So this is, we only sit there to have our dates. We don't administrate our marriage. So we'll bring a candlelight down there. We'll have our dinners. And when I walk by that table, it just puts a smile on my face, because it's like, we just tweaked some things, because it's our time now, and it's been great.
Absolutely. Just doing something different. And, you know, a lot of folks, that's one of the challenges that we wrestle with in the second half, is are we going to downsize? Are we going to move closer to our work, or sometimes closer to our children, depending on, you know, the situation? And that can be very good. It can also be traumatic, you know, especially if you're moving out of town where you've been all your life and you're going somewhere 600 miles away. You have to think, are we ready to leave all of our friends that we've been with for 30 years? And if you're moving to be closer to your children, you have to face the reality your children may move in 5 years.
That's right, exactly. That's exactly right.
I think also the mental state of the two of you, because if one of you is depressed and now you're going to make a move to go 600 miles away and leave your family and all that sort of thing, I'm telling you, if they're in a depressed state, that could push them over the edge. So you have to consider a lot of things before you make a move, but it can be a very positive thing.
Yeah, truly, I can see where maybe running away, so to speak, that doesn't solve anything. But if it feels like an invitation, right, that God is in it, and, you know, we prayed together, but we really sought God together. But I will tell you, working to get the house of 19 years ready to sell, we were rolling up our sleeves, and that project in itself made us laugh a lot and was good, hard work for us, and we so enjoyed it. Yeah. Well,
yeah.
You talk about some of the stresses that can be a catalyst to just driving a wedge between us. And one of them would be, you know, adult children maybe making choices that are breaking your heart. But there's even a way to navigate that. If we just let that thing play itself out, it'll stress us in our marriage. But you give some advice to the people who are walking through such a season. Don't blame yourself. Don't preach to your son or daughter. Don't try to fix it. Give your young adult unconditional love. Listen with empathy. Give them support. Give guidance. maybe grab a couple of those and speak to those for that person listening today saying, "But this is the empty nest is not as joyful as I thought because we're constantly stressed about our adult children."
Well, I think this is one of the common challenges of the second half, that often our children will make poor decisions. They may be single in college, and, you know, you get a phone call and says, "I'm pregnant, Mom," or "I got a girl pregnant," you know. Or maybe they're married, and now your child, your daughter, your son has actually moved out and left their wife or left their husband. A lot of decisions that our adult children make are poor decisions, and because they are our children, we care and we hurt. And so one of the things that I'm saying is, you know, don't blame yourself. And the reason I say that one, so many times they sit in my office torn apart by what their adult child has done. And here's what they say, Susie: "Where did we fail? What did we do wrong?" And I remind them that even God's two children, Adam and Eve, with a perfect father, made poor decisions. So don't blame yourself. Now, that doesn't mean that you're perfect, and you can certainly apologize for whatever you feel like, wherever you feel like you fail. But listen, if you brought them up in a Christian home, you took them to church, you exposed them to the truth, now as adults they're making poor decisions. Don't take the burden of that, the guilt of that on yourself. They are making decisions for themselves, and they will have to suffer the consequences. And that's one reason why I say don't try to fix it. Don't try to alleviate all the consequences of their poor decision, because you can't fix it in the first place. And if you alleviate and take away the consequences of their own struggle, then they're not going to learn from the experience. Because all of us learn that when we make poor decisions, there are consequences. We hurt other people as well as ourselves. So let them suffer the consequences. Now be there, express your love, and let them know you love them no matter what they do. But you can also share your emotions. "I'm disappointed." But don't preach to them, because they already know the truth. They already know what you're going to say. And so be there for them, but don't try to rescue them.
Don't you think there's something so powerful about, you know, entrusting them to God and enjoying your life in the meantime? Because I really think if they're wandering, they know what's true. And if they see you with a countenance of joy, enjoying your life, not like you're playing denial, but you truly are saying, "I'm going to enjoy the blessing of the Lord in the meantime," I feel like that would be something that would draw them back to the Lord and to you, right?
Absolutely. Look at the prodigal son's father. He didn't go chasing the prodigal son, trying to make him come back. He kept the farm going. So when his son came home, there was a farm to come home to.
Amen. That's a good word.
So I say, keep your own marriage alive. You know, don't let the decisions of your adult children destroy your marriage. You all enjoy life together so that when they do come back, they've got a model of what it looks like.
Oh, great advice. Talking to Dr. Gary Chapman, co-authored the book with Harold Myra, Married and Still Loving It, The Joys and Challenges of the Second Half. Talking about how to build a marriage that goes the distance. We need that today. More with Dr. Chapman when we return. There's a trend these days. People are talking about it. It's called gray divorce. It's when folks who've been married 20, 30, 40 years are deciding to call it quits. Well, our friend Dr. Gary Chapman joins us today to talk about a book he wrote to remedy that situation titled Married and Still Loving It, The Joys and Challenges of the Second Half. And he writes, "Marriage in the empty nest stage can be a time of companionship and contentment. Yet we can't ignore the realities of health limitations, worries about money, and the prospects for our own grown children. We may be lonely as friends move away. Some of us are watching parents fade into dementia. Others are still getting kids through college or wondering about the next stage of their work lives. The wisdom of aging sometimes looks more like an admission of how much you don't know." Would love you to talk more about what the second half looks like, because so often we're disillusioned when we get here because we're not prepared for it.
Yeah. Well, I think one of the things we observed in the couples who are thriving in the second half of marriage is they have learned to accept many of those things that in the earlier years irritated them. Mm. And not only accept them, but they've come to laugh at them. Mm. For example, my wife and I'm very organized, and she, to say the least, is not very organized, okay? Just by nature, okay? And so I load the dishwasher one way, she loads the dishwasher another way. Used to irritate me to death. You know, Carolyn, you know, had all kind of arguments over that issue. Now, I've learned to laugh at that. I just know she is not wired to load a dishwasher the way I do. In fact, the other day I walked in, I unload the dishwasher because I'm a morning person, and I walked in, opened the dishwasher, and here was a knife laying horizontal. And I'm thinking, I'm surprised it even stayed up there, you know, on that ledge.
Oh, it was a trap for
I'm
you.
Laughing now instead of condemning her, you know. Mm. And in the second half, I think if we haven't come to accept those things and to learn how to laugh about them, then they continue to irritate us through the second half. And life's too short for that.
Indeed.
You know, most of those things aren't worth a hill of beans. So let's learn how to accept those things that our spouse either cannot change or for some reason they choose not to change. And let's not let it destroy our relationship.
You know, that's so good. I used to tease my husband. He's a commercial construction project manager. So he estimates these giant, large-scale construction projects down to the little screw. You know, he just is a detailed guy. And I used to tease him, you can estimate these massive buildings to the screw, but you miss the laundry basket like every single time. You know what I mean? You can't estimate that distance. I don't get it. And now, you know, after 30 years, I mean, I laugh about it just because I love him so much. And I don't remember which guest said this to me, but they said they interviewed some of the wives of who lost husbands on 9/11, young wives. And they said the things that they used to nitpick about and fight about are the things they miss the most because it made them uniquely them. And this is what's true for us, truly, is I think we would miss those things. And we have grace for those things because we're married and God gives grace for those things, right?
Absolutely. You know, another issue, of course, there are several issues, the challenges of the second half. There's the health issue. Mm-hmm. Sooner or later, you're likely to have some health challenges. And then there's the aging parent issue. Chances are your parents are going to die before you do, and they may well need some care along the way. And that can be a bone of contention, but it's really a great opportunity to pay back to your parents. And I suggest to spouses where one of them is working with their own parent, encourage them. Do everything you can to help them. Don't complain, you know, you're never here anymore, you know. No, it's a wonderful opportunity for them to minister to their parents. And then you have the whole issue of retirement. To retire or not to retire? When would we retire? And so, you know, we say you've got to ask some questions. Why do you want to retire? And there are good reasons. Sometimes there's health reasons. You're not healthy enough to continue. Sometimes your job is very, very stressful, and you can't go on another 10 years or 5 years living under that stress. They're good reasons, but why are you going to retire? And what are you going to do when you retire? This is a huge issue. I've found that couples who retire and they think, well, we're just going to relax and just do what we want to do. In 3 months, they're bored to death because they have nothing to do. And I say, you know, have some plans. And keep in mind, as Christians, we're here to serve. So look for opportunities to serve. Maybe you can start doing something in your church you've never done before, something in your community you've never done. I was in Thailand some time ago. I met a couple. He was 85 and she was 84. They were living in Thailand, teaching English as a second language, using the Bible as their guide in terms of what they were teaching, and having wonderful opportunities and wonderful inroads to share the good news of Christ. And I said to them, how do you support yourselves? He said, well, we get our Social Security, and I get a little check of my pension. He said, it's plenty for us. And I said, well, how long do you plan to do this? And he said, well, as long as we have health. He said, you know, we have no desire to move to Florida and sit in a rocking chair and wait to die. And I thought, man.
That's amazing. And it challenges all of us, doesn't it? Wow.
Yeah. Because I think sometimes in the second half, people have dreams of we're going to retire and we're going to be happy. We're going to travel. We're going to do all these wonderful things. And they fail to recognize the deepest satisfaction in life is not from trying to make yourself happy. Now, I'm not opposed to any of those things, But the greatest satisfaction comes in pouring your life out in serving other people.
Hmm.
And when you do that, you get to the end of the road with deep satisfaction.
So good. Got another excerpt from your book I'd love for you to speak to. We just got a couple minutes here before we pray. But you write, thinking about the future should lead us to take constructive steps to prepare for the future. But good plans are not enough. We must also trust God. We cannot control all of the events that will happen in our future. We must trust God to give us grace and wisdom to face those events when they happen. Kind of reminds me of the passage, man makes his plan, but the Lord determines his steps. Say a word about that, if you would.
Yeah, I think often that we worry rather than being concerned.
Mm-hmm.
Concern moves you to action. You know, what can I do to get ready for the future, for example? And so you take steps to get ready for the future. But worry focuses on what might happen. And it's the word literally means to be torn apart. You allow your emotional state to be torn apart about what might happen. And 90% of the time it doesn't happen. And if it does happen, you can't do anything to prevent it. So trust God when you get there that he will give you grace to handle those things that are beyond your control. In the meantime, you do what you know you can do about any situation so that you're doing your part and the rest you trust God. You know, the scriptures say, don't worry about anything, but pray about everything.
Mm.
And when you put it in God's hands and trust him, you'll be all right.
Mm. Such a good word. Just another moment here before we pray, Dr. Chapman, but I'd love for you to just to cast a vision for the ripple effect of one marriage that goes the distance, and they don't just stay together. They really thrive together, where they actually love each other. They prefer each other. Talk about the ripple effect of one healthy marriage.
You know, I can guarantee you, when a couple has been married 40 years, stands up and speaks to a group of younger couples, and tells them they've been married 40 years, there will be an applause in the audience.
Mm.
Because those younger couples want to have a lifetime marriage. And when we give them a model of that, we're greatly influencing and encouraging them. And the other thing is, I would suggest that every couple in the second half have at least one younger couple that they are inviting to lunch once a month and just having a conversation. And in the normal overflow of conversation, they will be able to build into that young couple's lives and impact them for a lifetime. What would happen if every Christian couple in the second half had a young couple that they were meeting with on a regular basis and just normally and naturally talking and sharing with them? I believe it would save thousands of marriages in the long run.
Boy, thanks for casting that vision. Imagine that. I think I've told you before, we've got mentors who've invited us for a candlelight dinner once a month, and I think it's been 12 years. We still do it. You get to see them this weekend. And I mentor some young gals, but I feel challenged just by what you just said to do that for couples, to reach out to young couples and take them to lunch and just talk and let them ask questions. Wow. Well, Dr. Chapman, thank you so much for all you've done for marriage, for family. As we wrap up, I'm wondering if you pray for that couple listening today who they're hanging on by a thread and they're realizing giving up isn't the easier route. Would you pray for them?
Sure. Father, you know those who are listening today. You know everything about them. You know where they are in the journey. And I know that you can give them the ability to put their hand in your hand and keep walking. And I know that if they keep walking with you, you will lead them in the right direction. So, Father, give them courage, give them wisdom, give them comfort. In the name of Christ, amen.
Mm. Again, Gary, thank you for all that you do for the family and for marriage and just for giving us your time today.
Well, thank you, Susie. Always good to be with you.
I always appreciate you as well. Title of his book, Married and Still Loving It, The Joys and Challenges of the Second Half.
I can say.
Wow, I hope you were as encouraged today as I was. You've been listening to Live the Promise. I'm Susie Larson. In just a bit, you know the drill. You'll find the podcast up on our website at myfaithradio.com. Be a radio missionary and share it with a friend. Somebody needs that encouragement today. And remember this, the Lord wants you to last long and finish strong. He is the one who'll keep you strong to the end. Have a blessed and amazing day.